KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Carnival Cruise Lines offers upgrades based on clout scores, and Amazon is this close to pricing goods based on a customer's online reputation. According to technologist Joshua Klein, online reputation is replacing currency. How will this affect our future interactions with each other and with businesses? Klein is the author of Reputation Economics: Why Who You Know is Worth More Than What You Have. He spoke at Town Hall on January 9th, 2014.
So the premise behind this book is that we are discovering new ways or new uses for the concept of value and for wealth. One of the ways that I like to start out this conversation of what is changing by virtue of these new and emerging technologies is to ask what your mom is worth. And this is intentionally a little bit provocative. The reason why I ask this question is that I think that the way you go about answering it is going to help determine how wealthy you are over the next 5 to 20 years. And I'll explain that through the course of this talk. The first way that most people go about answering this question is sort of ironically or perhaps perversely to talk about money. And this is one of the essential arguments behind the book, is to say that people use this idea of money to define value or wealth across the board. So if I asked you how much your mother is worth, you might be a little bit taken aback, or at least I would kind of hope that you would be. But in fact, this is a really normal question to ask. So if you were Hallmark, for example, you might decide that your mom is worth $1.50 to acquire her as a customer. If you were a retirement home, you might decide that your mom is worth $1,000 or more, because over the lifetime of her residency, she would generate X amount of capital. And that, compared to the amount of money that it takes to acquire her as a customer, gives you an exact amount that you can then calculate down to fractions of a cent, which is a little bit of an odd way to think about value when it comes to talking about your mom. At least it is for me. Now, to explain why and how that happened, I think it helps to understand a little bit about money itself as a concept, currency, particularly where it came from. One of the ways that it was explained to me was that money arose to address limitations of scope and scale. And if you think back into the old days when we all lived in little villages, and you were in your little valley, and you had your carpenter and your butcher and your baker and your local agrarian society, things were fairly finite. They were fairly limited, right? And being able to grow your business, to grow the market that you would address and whatnot, was also similarly limited. And those limitations were then addressed by money. So to give you an idea, if you were a pot maker, you're a potter, you would have some problems if you went to the butcher and said, hey, I'd really like a steak, and the butcher said, yeah, but I don't need any pots, right? So one of the things that money lets you do is to say, hey, butcher, when you do need a pot, come and buy some pots from me, and then later, when I need a steak, I can take that money that you gave me, and I can go back to you and give you the money, and you'll give me the steak then. So this is one of the first things that money did, is it let us store value long term, which is sort of a revolutionary thing. The second thing that it did was it let us do things like take our pots and sell them to the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, and then at the end of the season we could take all that money, we could go over to the carpenter and we could say, hey carpenter, here's a bunch of money, make me a house, which is a much better proposition than saying, hey carpenter, here's 1,000 pots, why don't you make me a house, because that's kind of weird, right? The last thing that money did, so that allows us to scale value. The last thing it did was it changed scope entirely. It allowed us to take our pots, give them to a merchant. The merchant could go over to the next valley where none of our people have ever gone and sell those pots and then come back and give us some portion of the proceeds. So these limitations were all being addressed by money in ways that we had no solution to prior to the invention. And this was all a good thing, right? So much so that money has now become the most intuitive or most normal way of handling the storage and exchange of value around the world. We all think in terms of money most of the time. So much so that when I ask you what your mother is worth, it's not entirely obtuse, which is a little bit strange. Now, the reason that I think that this is relevant to the concept of wealth and how it's changing over the next few years is that we have advanced this concept of monetizing or quantifying value so much that we're now starting to use it in some kind of strange ways. And I'm talking particularly about like monetizing privacy, for example, particularly through the use of big data, which everyone likes to talk about big data, so please bear with me. One of the things that's a little bit odd about all this big data is that we have lots and lots of it, and we're able to start determining sort of unusual trends and aspects of value that we never could before, right? Like, used to be you could make a good estimation that if you were a male between the age of 20 and 25, your buying power was such, and, you know, you could figure stuff out from it. But now we've got capabilities that far exceed that. So, for example, let's say that you're in a very rich neighborhood and you go onto Amazon to buy some toilet paper. You're going to get one price. If you then go to a very poor neighborhood and go to buy that same toilet paper, you'll get a different price entirely, right? Well, again, this isn't that weird. It's essentially what, like a deli chain would do the same thing. If they have a store in a poor neighborhood and a rich neighborhood, they'll do different prices because they don't want to leave money on the table in the rich neighborhood and they don't want to lose customers in the poor neighborhood. So that's not too strange. But that way of thinking has now advanced along with the technology. So 5 or 6 years ago, Microsoft came up with a couple patents that they released. The first one of those allowed them to quantify anyone's ability to influence others around a word or topic. So let's say that you have a really great blog about cheese that's enormously popular, right? Congrats on that blog. And let's say that you have no blog about cheese, no interest in cheese, and in fact the only public record of your relationship to cheese is you tweeted once about being lactose intolerant and having a terrible incident with a burrito. So you have a very low score. You have a score of 8 with cheese. So the second patent that Microsoft released allows them to dynamically price goods or services based on that score. So what that means is that if you both go online to buy some Kraft singles, Kraft can say, hey, you know, this person has a great score around cheese, so we're going to reduce the price by 47.8%, which gives us a 90% chance that she'll actually make the purchase, which will then likely amortize our marketing costs by X amount per year. So great, good investment, you get a good deal. On the other hand, you go to buy some cheese, Kraft can then say, ooh, that could go bad. You know, we're going to triple the price, which will almost guarantee that he doesn't buy our cheese. We don't have to worry about cheese-related incidents, no bad PR. Perfect. Now, this is excellent for Kraft, right? Because it means that they can then dynamically adjust prices enough that they're always selling their cheese at the maximum amount that will guarantee a sale. But that's not so good for you, or at least it's not so good for you. Probably pretty good for you, but you know, you're spending all your time writing about cheese. So what's curious about that is that this is now, this way of thinking, this concept of monetizing everything, in this case monetizing privacy, is now going offline. So online, you can turn off the computer. You can choose not to buy your cheese on Amazon.com. But if you go in the real world, you are starting to see the same sort of thing happen. So, for example, city buses. Anyone here ride the bus? I can't see you anyway, so I'm going to assume you're riding the bus. Thank you. So if you're riding the bus, you know how they have cameras in the buses? Well, an increasing number of buses in different cities are installing microphones so that they can record the conversations of everyone who happens to be on the bus. And this makes a lot of sense if you're very, very concerned about terrorists, because you can, of course, stream all that audio to a server somewhere else, and then you can convert it to text, and then you can look for keywords. But it's also a great marketing research mechanism, right? Because I can then watch the video of you and listen to everything you say, and if you say Coca-Cola, then I can go ahead and see if you're smiling, or if you're looking at someone, or if you're looking at someone of the opposite sex, or if, you know, I can determine a lot of context that's really, really useful about you. Similarly, the commodification of hardware is starting to have an effect in the same way. So you know how, well, you may not have known, but a lot of stores for a while now have done things where they will test the sales or the structure of different goods in their stores, how the different aisles are set up and whatnot, by putting infrared cameras in the back of the shelves. And then they will watch what products you look at, how long you look at them, and if and when you pick them up and put them in your basket or not. Well, that's a little bit weird, but they were just doing it for testing, except now they're starting to put it everywhere, because why wouldn't you, right? The storage is cheap, the processing is cheap, the cameras are cheap, and it means that they get real-time data over the long haul. They get more big data. Similarly, we're starting to see new technologies which take this even a step further. So picosecond lasers are being deployed now over the next 2 to 3 years in different airports. Picosecond lasers are pretty interesting in that they can scan everyone in a 50-meter radius and determine whether they have explosive residue on their shoe or drug material in their hair. They can also do things like determine what your adrenaline levels are or how much caffeine you had for breakfast. They can determine your heart rate, your breath rate. They can see the temperature of any particular part of your body. In other words, they're able to gather a lot of information. And of course, right now, they're just being deployed in airports. But again, the hardware and the technology is being commodified over time. And you have to ask yourself, how appealing would this information be to someone who's trying to sell you something? Because I recently spoke to someone who's a major retailer, and his response was, how soon can I get it? Because, you know, who wouldn't want to be able to dynamically price something based on how much your heart rate increased when you picked it up off the shelf? That's really good for the person who's selling things. So the upshot of this is that we're now able to quantify down to a very finite amount, or a very, very, very high degree of accuracy, exactly what any one person is worth in any one situation, context, time, etc. So going forward, you will be parted from your money more efficiently than ever before. So that's one way to answer the question, is to say my mom is worth this amount. The other way to answer the question is to look at how we did transactions before money existed at all. And I think that this is where things get really interesting. We used to think about people not in terms of their net worth, but in terms of their network. You like that? A little bit of wordplay there for you. So before we had cash or before we had money, we did things through trade and gift and barter. In other words, we relied on our relationships. So if I was the potter and I wanted some steak, I would go to the butcher and say, hey, I gave you some pots earlier this year. Could you hook me up? And we would have a relationship such that he may or may not give me some meat. Maybe it would just be some stew meat. Maybe it would be a fine cut. That would depend on our relationship, how many pots he got, whether he's trying to marry my sister, you know, a bunch of other factors all begin to come into play. The point is that that's basically how the human brain is designed. If I ask you how much effort or how much money you're willing to spend on your sister's birthday card, you have a pretty good idea without having to think about it very hard. You don't have to have a big database of every relationship or every interaction you've had with your sister. It's because that's how your brain is hardwired. So what we're starting to see is these models of pre-financial exchange occur. And one of the things that's interesting about these models is that they provide an opportunity for transactions which can make you richer than the current mechanism of using money. And I'll explain what I mean. Essentially, when you are one person trading something with another person, and there are only two people involved, so I'm cutting out the middleman here entirely in this analogy, you can do something called a double coincidence of wants. So let's say again that I'm the potter and that you're the butcher and you have an excess of meat, so meat is low value to you, but you really desperately need some pots. I have an excess of pots, so pots are low value to me, but I desperately want some steak. We can then trade to each other at what is actually at the low market rate and get a return that is above market rate, right? Because I'm giving you a good that's of low value to me, so I give it to you for cheap, and you give me, but I give you more of it, and you do the same in return, and we both make more from the transaction than we would have if we'd used market rate exchange. Well, this is a great thing when it happens. But again, when you're in a tiny village, what's the chances that the butcher happens to really want some pots at the same time that you really want some steak? So in that way, these pre-financial models are much more limited. Now, what's curious about that is those limitations of being in a small village that make this so unusual and so unique, this double coincidence of wants, those are the same limitations that has made money so important for so long. Those limitations are now largely gone because we have the internet, and now we're all in the same village, which is a little bit unique. And that's where I think we're starting to see what I'm calling the reputation economy, which is that I can now go online, get enough information about anyone in the world to determine if I want to do a direct exchange with them. So what this is doing is creating a bunch of new platforms. So we're starting to see new technologies come up which take advantage of these old pre-financial models, except now they're jacking them up on all these on the new scope and scale that the internet provides, and people are starting to really like them. And so you're seeing stuff like neighbor goods, where you can figure out if you have a neighbor who lives nearby that has a lawnmower but really needs a hedge trimmer, and you happen to have a hedge trimmer and you want the lawnmower, or Uber, which can tell you that there's someone driving a car in the direction you want to go, and they drive safely enough for your tastes, and they're willing to do it for a price that you want to pay. Delightful. Or Headliner, who can put you in touch with someone who has an audience that wants a message that you want to convey, and they have a message that your audience wants to hear. So there's all these platforms that are out there that are saying, okay, this person here needs what this person over here has, and that person wants what this person has, and they're starting to arrange these double coincidence of wants to occur all over the planet. So this is a sort of an odd thing. What's curious about that, I mean, I started discovering that these platforms were popping up all over the place, and I was thinking, well, that's really nice, but, you know, is that really compelling enough? I mean, what's the advantage of this over the old model of just buying stuff? Because really, we've kind of got that down, right? So as I asked that, the first answer was pretty obvious. The existing models of financial exchange that we're using now are having some problems. You may have noticed the euro crisis, for example, the subprime mortgage crisis. These huge systems of exchange, which are solely based on money, are failing a lot of people in a lot of pretty significant ways. And so people are now having to find new ways to leverage value in their lives to create either more money or more value for themselves, because their money is just not doing enough for them. So you see stuff like Skillshare, which lets you take that scuba diving habit and then go teach some classes and make a little bit of extra money that way. Or TaskRabbit, which takes your hobby of, well, not your hobby, but the fact that you're really good at assembling IKEA furniture and lets you make some money doing that. Or Rideshare, which takes that fancy car that you bought but you only use on weekends and lets you rent it out over the weekday. So in other words, it's taking stuff that you had which was non-monetized and allowing you to monetize it at scale. So that's nice, and it's pretty self-explanatory.
Joshua Klein, the author of Reputation Economics, Why Who You Know is Worth More Than What You Have. He spoke at Town Hall on January 9th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Joshua Klein in a moment, 923, 94.9 KUOW. Men have been using hormones at much higher rates in recent years, but a new study shows older men could be at greater risk for heart attacks and strokes if they take testosterone. A conversation about the safety of prescribing testosterone tonight at midnight. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 20s, mostly cloudy. Chance of light snow or flurries mainly this evening. Friday highs lower to mid-30s, mostly cloudy. Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance, recognizing people have a choice about where they're treated for cancer. At SCCA, doctors from Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, UW Medicine, and Seattle Children's unite to turn cancer patients into cancer survivors. More at seattlecca.org. Support for KUOW comes from the King County Library System, providing tools, tips, and techniques to start on the road to fitness. The KCLS will have ideas and inspiration available for a healthier lifestyle throughout the year. More information at kcls.org/fitness.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. The value of an online reputation is on the rise, creating a new type of currency based on that reputation. This means that companies are tracking what we're tweeting and what sites we spend time on. And they're using that information to predict what we're going to buy in the future. Joshua Klein is a technologist and the author of Reputation Economics, Why Who You Know is Worth More Than What You Have. He spoke about this new age of business at Town Hall on January 9th, 2014.
More interesting is this drive behind meaning. And as I stumbled across this, I had a real problem with it because my background's with technology and I like it when things can be measured. But in fact, I think the immeasurable aspect of this is what drives people's interest in it. It's a lot like shade-grown coffee. You remember shade-grown coffee came out and suddenly everyone's paying 25 cents more for their cup of coffee because it's got to be shade-grown? Well, that coffee doesn't necessarily taste better, but it feels better. There's an ethical return. And that can actually drive people pretty heavily. To give you an example, car sales, which have long been iconic of status symbols here in the U.S., they are down. They were down 20% last year in 2013, whereas at the same time, new services like Airbnb are way, way up. Airbnb had 10 million nights booked in 2012, and that had doubled over 5 months. So they're witnessing explosive growth. And I think the reason for that is that when you use Airbnb, you're having an experience. You're having a meaningful experience. I recently talked to a bank executive, because I was doing interviews for this book, who was saying that he had gone and stayed in a crummy little poet's apartment in the Left Bank of Paris and how great that was. And I was saying, well, were you trying to save money? What was driving you on that? I mean, you could have stayed in a Hilton. And he said, well, yeah, but you know, if you stay in the Hilton in Paris, it's the same as the Hilton in Rio de Janeiro, in Hamburg, or in San Francisco, or anywhere else. But there's only one crummy poet's apartment in the Left Bank. Of course, there's obviously many, but there's... In this case, for him, there was only one. And for him, he'd always wanted to be a poet in the Left Bank of Paris, so sleeping on this guy's ratty futon was a meaningful experience that he was willing to invest a lot in having. Another good summary of this for me was a friend of mine bought a tea cozy on Etsy. You guys know Etsy?
No.
So Etsy is a platform for where people who make handicrafts will go online and sell. And you can then go and buy their different goods. Well, this friend of mine ended up on Etsy, and she found a tea cozy that she wanted to buy for her mom. And so she bought this tea cozy for $40, which is an expensive tea cozy, right? And I asked her why she spent $40 on this tea cozy when she could go to Walmart and buy one for $2. And she explained that she'd been browsing around on Etsy, and there's this little old lady in Minnesota who made these tea cozies, and she was like, she did them in patriotic colors, and her mom liked that. And she ended up in a conversation with this woman. Turns out that they had some things in common. The woman's daughter had passed away some years before, and she had planted a garden, and she had these flowers, and the flowers were the same things that my friend's mom's liked. And, you know, so like they had this whole thing going on. And then she bought the tea cozy, and this little old lady was sending videos on YouTube every week of the progress on the tea cozy as it came into being. And then the tea cozy was finished, and she got it, and it came in hand-pressed paper with flowers pressed into the paper, and they were the same flowers that her daughter liked, that the, you know, on and on. So this woman took this tea cozy, gave it to her mom, they watched all the videos, they read the emails, they smelled the paper, it was the whole thing that they did. And now her mom uses this tea cozy every day. And I said, well, that's great. I guess your mom drinks a lot of tea. And she's like, no, my mom doesn't really like tea, but she uses it every day now because of all the meaning invested in this tea cozy. So for my friend, that meaning was worth $38, right? Well, in fact, it was worth quite a bit more. And I think that it's that impetus which is driving the development of all these platforms. So we're starting to see a bunch of new platforms like this which are evolving based on pre-financial models. That's pretty sweet. People can now go and stay in crummy apartments in Paris. That's nice. You can buy tea cozies for a lot of money. That's cool. Really, why is this important? Why is this changing the world? I think that what we're witnessing now is really just the tip of the iceberg. And we're all playing around the sandbox thinking that this is really cute, but things are about to change. And part of the reason I say that is as I was doing research into this trend, I started talking to some friends of mine that work internationally with a variety of NGOs and whatnot. And they eventually, and someone in particular, interrupted me and said, you know what you're talking about, this trade, barter, gift, etc. It is happening on a lot of these platforms, and that's very nice, but it's also the predominant way that exchange happens throughout the world, particularly in the emerging economy. It's just that we call it the black market, right? And I thought, well, that's a good point. That's pretty interesting. I started looking into it. It turns out that the black market's actually pretty big, like $10 trillion annually big. Now, to give you a point of comparison, the U.S. economy, which is the biggest in the world, is $14 trillion. That's kind of notable. It's also really global. Every market in the world has a black market equivalent. In the U.S., one out of every $7 is traded on the black market, according to some estimates. And now that sounds like a crazy large amount, but if you stop and think about it, when you pay the babysitter, that's black market, unless you've got your babysitter on a W-2, in which case I pity your babysitter. You buy some lemonade at a lemonade stand, it's black market. The black market is alive and well for almost everybody. The other thing that's interesting is that it's growing. So right now, it's estimated that by 2020, two-thirds of all the world's workers will be exchanging the bulk of their wealth on the black market. That's big. That means that the existing financial systems are about to be wedged out. Where this gets really interesting, we already know that the black market exists, and we can all posit what the impact on the global economy is going to be as it gets bigger and bigger. The reason I think that this is an immediate concern is that right now, the percent of people who are relying on this are roughly two-thirds of the human race. That's the number of people who are not on the internet and generally not using first world economies in the same way that people on the internet are. The reason that's important is that those people are about to join us all. Like I say us, because I'm presuming that you are people that are on the internet. When they start coming online, they're going to have different attitudes around commerce than we are, right? They don't use things the same way that we do. Smartphones, tablets, computers and whatnot are going to become available to them, and they're going to have to make a decision. Are they going to go and make a checking account at Citibank, or are they going to open up a Bitcoin wallet and start swapping funds? Well, my bet is that it's going to be the latter more than the former, not least because Citibank won't have them, right? In order to get a Citibank account or to get a bank account in general, you have to have a steady address, social security number, you have to be literate, you have to understand complex financial mechanisms like checking accounts or credit cards or what have you. They could make the choice of trying to get those things, or in 30 seconds, they could open a Bitcoin wallet and start trading funds with no taxes, you know, no government oversight, no limitations. They can, if they have a good online reputation, get a Square dongle and plug that into the top of their phone and then start swiping your credit card. So the question in my mind, that's happening over the next 5 to 20 years. So I call this capitalism's Napster moment. Yeah, if you used to like Napster, that will grab your attention. So Napster was a website that was designed when someone realized that music files or songs could be traded as easily as pictures of cats, right? And so this guy, Sean Fanning, grabbed them all and put them on a website, and then everyone was able to download music for free. This was a big party. Until the Recording Industry Association of America came on and said, hey, yeah, you know, you're walking all over a business model that's not going to work, and they completely shut them down. The reason I think that's relevant to what's going on now is that what happened next was that the internet did not collectively throw up its hands and say, oh, we don't get to have free music anymore, bummer, right? Instead, somebody invented BitTorrent, and everyone started downloading music for free in a different way. And eventually RIAA came along and started shutting down BitTorrent sites, and so then we invented better access to VPNs and better encryption software and invite-only file sharing sites and a bunch of means that allowed us to do exactly the same thing except more resistant to being stopped by the people that didn't want us to do that. In fact, this arm race continued until a hardware company came along, Apple, and they said, okay, well, hold up. We'll give you your song, and we'll wrap it in a music player, and we'll put some cover art there, and we'll tie it into your social networks, and we'll put some reviews, and we'll let you play it on a bunch of devices, and we'll just charge you $1 a song. And for most people, that was a pretty good agreement, right? That sounded pretty good. But it didn't stop piracy. It didn't end the availability of free music online. Quite the opposite. What's happening there is exactly the same thing that's happening with other platforms that are using these pre-financial models of exchange. So Uber, for example, is in a big argument right now with, from what I understand, the city of Seattle, right, where it's basically threatening the existing infrastructure for car or ride purchasing. Airbnb has the same thing in New York, where they're basically trying to keep Airbnb from being there. And I think that ultimately they will be crushed the same way that Napster was. Yeah, I know. This is a sad thing. The good news is that it's not going to go away. And what will come up in their stead will be something that's more resistant to being destroyed by existing legislation or whoever it is that stops them from happening. It will be more flexible, and it will be better suited to the 65.7% of humanity who are about to come online and for whom those methods of exchange are entirely intuitive. That's where I think things are about to change. So that leads me to the question of what comes next. Because as we decide how we are going to exchange goods and services, how we're going to trade these things with other people, how we're going to buy or sell things, we have the option of doing it the same way that we always have, except better, more efficiently, more profitably, right? In other words, focusing on money. Or we have the option of looking more abundance-oriented, looking for those double coincidences of wants, and trying to set things up for our mothers. Thanks very much.
Joshua Klein, the author of Reputation Economics, Why Who You Know is Worth More Than What You Have. He spoke at Town Hall on January 9th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at kuowspeakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Joshua Klein in a moment. 9:37, 94.9 KUOW. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight: lows in the 20s, mostly cloudy, chance of light snow or flurries, mainly this evening. Friday highs lower to mid-30s, mostly cloudy. Friday night lows mid to upper 20s, mostly cloudy, chance of snow after midnight. Saturday highs mid to upper 30s, mostly cloudy, chance of snow. Pianist, singer, composer, and producer Alan Toussaint talks about his long music career and performs some of his songs, including Mother-in-Law and Southern Nights, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from lynda.com, offering more than 2,000 online video courses in photography, web design, business, and more. More information at lynda.com. Learn something new today.
KUOW would like to thank Microsoft and its employees, the Cape Flattery Foundation, the Kongsgaard Goldman Foundation, the Real Networks Foundation, Wincote Foundation Northwest, and our other corporate and private foundation contributors for their support of public radio and their commitment to building a vibrant community through corporate contributions and foundation grants.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Joshua Klein is a technologist whose ventures include a project designed to train crows to fetch lost change. More recently, he's the author of Reputation Economics, Why Who You Know is Worth More Than What You Have. In the book, he argues that online reputation has the ability to replace currency, and in some ways, it already has. Klein spoke at Town Hall on January 9th, 2014. Next, he takes questions from the audience.
So I'm seeing two different things that you're talking about here. You've got the big data and commodities like the toilet paper, and then we've got this emerging group of, I guess you could call it this emerging economy, the black market economy, that is not at this point affected by big data so much because they're not online necessarily. How do you see this group that's coming online and it is operating within this black market becoming a part of all this data collection and being marketed to the same way as the rest of us who are using Amazon and all these other services and getting tracked all the time?
Right. I think there's two ways to answer that. The first is that the black market benefits from many of the same things that the existing economy does. I was recently at a hoity-toity party for startups in New York City, and someone made a joke about bringing pot brownies to the after party, but his drugs didn't arrive. They were late. And I made some joke about dealers being unreliable. And everyone kind of laughed awkwardly about it. And I was like, well, come on, why'd that fall flat? And they're like, well, who buys drugs from a drug dealer, really? And I was like, well, how do you buy your drugs? And they're like, well, of course, we get them online. How else are you going to have peer review? So I think there's a little bit of a change happening about how people are considering doing purchasing and what kind of infrastructure you need around your purchasing decisions. So that's the first answer. The second answer is that as all these big companies are using big data to qualify us and figure out how to sell things to us, people are going to start fighting back. I mean, you could set up a system that takes a variety of accounts and analyzes what prices each one of them pays for any particular good, and then you buy into this system and you use whatever account is going to yield you the best price for a particular good. In other words, the same technologies that big companies are using now are accessible to individuals, increasingly much so, and increasingly much so at scale. So I think we're going to see the same sort of arms race that we have in the past. Should we tag team? You could arm wrestle.
Well, first off, when you couldn't see us for the first third of the talk, when you told us about everything that could happen, we were all aghast, right? We were all going...
Great. Oh, I love that.
So, question and a comment. The question is, can and will. So, I use the supermarket, the old supermarket loyalty card, and have for ages. I don't see that they use that to give me, a couple of coupons, but... they still discontinue some of the things I buy and like, and it's not clear to me that they've used that data particularly well.
Okay.
So a lot of can, Amazon could. I don't know if people are tracking my eyes. So would you give me a sense as to where we are from can to will in terms of pervasiveness? And then the second one is a comment, and that is that back more in the days of trade, the Quakers were some of the first people to say, to believe in fixed price stores. So I would sell you the same. You would pay the same for the steak as somebody else,
right,
even though he's a better negotiator than you, let's say. And it was a value that they implemented, which eventually became somewhat popular. Do you think there could be a movement where that would come back?
Possibly. I mean, I think it depends on the market and the context in which people are buying. That's just a quick response to the second question. The first one, I think I might be able to shed a little more light on. When you buy things at the store and you aren't seeing immediate response in terms of the price for the goods that you happen to buy, that doesn't mean they're not using the data. They're just using it in aggregate for the X million people that they have records on. So what does that mean? How is that actually being used? I think the best example I can give you of that is what happened with Target and pregnant women. So some people have heard about this. What Target did 5 years ago, 3 years ago, something like this, was to realize that the most profitable time to acquire a new customer was when they were going through a period of life transition. So if you have a baby, that's the most optimal time, because not only are you going through a life transition, but you suddenly need a lot of stuff. So they tried to start figuring out, how can I determine who is about to have a child and then focus my marketing in such a way that they will convert to being a Target customer? And they got some data scientists on this, and they started buying credit card purchasing history, information, stuff from those little swipe cards, local demographic information, and they discovered that they could predict with a very high degree of accuracy, in fact, sometimes before the person knew themselves, who was about to have a baby, who was about to become pregnant. Right? This is very useful. And they would take our advertising, and they found that as long as it wasn't too obvious, you just put some more ads for strollers next to the wine glasses, or you put some more ads for diapers next to the toilet paper or what have you, they could convert a significant number of people into customers, right? Particularly women who are about to get pregnant. And so all was grand for Target for quite some time. Until this information came out, and people freaked out, because it turns out that people were asking themselves, hold on, did I have a baby because I wanted a baby? Or did I have a baby because Target was advertising to me? Which sounds a little crazy, but, you know, when you're having a baby, you think like that. So maybe that answers your question of how much is going on right now. The answer is quite a lot. Was there another question?
Thank you. I read your excellent book and really enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
One of the things that I wondered about that you didn't really address is that dollars are cumulative additively. You know, $200 is twice $100. But reputation is kind of a multiplier effect. And when you put those together, it has some interesting implications, and I wonder if you'd talk to that.
Okay. Do you want to qualify that, or do you just want me to ramble in response?
Ramble.
All right. We're off. One of the things that I find very interesting about reputation is that at a certain point, you can't trade any more of it, right? Like, I might have a good reputation, which means that I might be able to convince you to loan me your car, but I'm unlikely to get you to just give me your car, right? So it's powerful, but not in the same way that dollars are powerful as a neutral value of exchange. I guess I would sum it up by saying I recently had a conversation with a guy who writes articles in LA who was one of the first people who was recommended by Twitter. You remember Twitter came up and started saying you might like a person, this person? He happened to be on that list of 15 people that first got put up. And so he had suddenly a million followers, like literally a million followers basically overnight. And so he came to me to say, you know, you just wrote this book, tell me how to get rich off of these million followers. And I was like, well, that's not really how it works. It's more about, you know, your relationships. What do you want to do? And he said, well, I want to race NASCAR. You know, how do I get someone to sell me a NASCAR, you know, permission or whatever? And I was like, well, really, you should ask your community for, you know, who can hook you up with a NASCAR driver or something like that. Now, coincidentally, a few weeks later, I had a friend of mine who I got in a conversation with. We're talking about NASCAR, and he was saying, hey, you know, we're shooting a TV pilot. We need someone to just drive the car. Why don't you come out and drive this NASCAR for us? I mean, you were just talking about it. You might as well. And so I got to go and drive NASCAR. Awesome. And this guy in LA with a million Twitter followers did not. Because when he went and asked those million Twitter followers, it was nothing but crickets because no one actually communicated with him. They just signed up with him because he happened to be on a list. He didn't tweet. He didn't develop a relationship with them at all. Whereas I was having a conversation with a human being who was then able to deliver on this promise of NASCAR. The point being that it's qualitative, highly qualitative. And what you can get from any particular relationship varies greatly. So is it powerful? Yes. Have we figured out how to predict that and use it universally? No. But that's human beings for you. They're messy.
Could you just talk a minute about the you're talking about how corporations are analyzing our behavioral profiles every time we get on the internet, so some record is created. So could you talk about whether there is an interface between what NSA does in terms of the metadata collection and what corporations are doing, which is metadata collection, perhaps with a different objective, but shouldn't NSA be really, you know, Skyping into what the corporations are doing? Because they're the ones who have all the real information about all of us on a more, perhaps more individual basis. And you had the word privacy up on the board for a while, but you never really talked about that in terms of the loss of it to corporations versus the loss of it to other kinds of surveillance programs that also collect metadata, perhaps for other reasons. But is there really any difference between what Procter & Gamble does or what Target does and what NSA does? Why do we care?
Well, I think the reason we care may be a little self-evident, although I would hearken us back to such organizations as the SS or the Nazi Party, who made great use of data that had been collected to very efficiently kill a lot of people, which is to say that having data collected does not always result in positive things.
If I were to postulate that a Muslim fundamentalist with a Middle Eastern accent is going to eat falafel every Friday night, and maybe also only go to a certain kinds of stores, can my corporations or other government agencies then locate who I am, where I am, based upon my behavioral quotient?
Right, exactly. And then the question becomes, are they going to use that data in a way that's really appropriate? And I think that that's where the concern really lies, because these models which are being used are only as good as the questions that are asked of them. We're gathering loads and loads of data. Anyone who's worked with large data sets knows that just because you've got the information doesn't mean it's going to produce useful results, and a lot of that has to do with the model that you use to analyze it. So, for example, to your example of profiling someone based on their ethnicity, and then postulating on their behavior and possible political beliefs, etc., this may be useful in general, but if you then go out and imprison every single person that fits the profile, you're going to get a lot of false positives. And in some cases, false positives can really destroy people's lives. So, yes, that's a concern.
Thank you for this talk. I find myself wondering, what are the implications for cash? Like, if you have some cash, and in the future, say I'm saving for retirement, or I'm saving for the future, whatever it is, and I've got this pile of cash, and I'm wondering, should I be changing my investment strategy? Does this, or is that a different topic? I mean, is this about purchasing things, or is this also, is the big change coming going to hit me somehow or hit us?
Yes.
How?
Okay. To all of the above. The premise that I lead to in my book is not that cash and money is going to vanish, because honestly, it serves some really useful purposes. I think that the premise and the threat of this emerging reputation economy is that we suddenly have a lot of new markets to choose from with which to make exchanges, whether that be bartering goods and services, or buying Bitcoin in order to avoid paying certain taxes, or trading in euros versus trading in yen versus trading in dollars, or Linden dollars, or World of Warcraft gold coins, or whatever it is, we suddenly have other options. Now, the promise of that is that we can then use that to optimize our transactions, right? I can give you something that's of low value to me in exchange for something that's of high value, and that may be of low value to you, but high value to me. The threat, of course, is that this introduces a lot of volatility, and maybe all that money you have under your mattress is suddenly going to be of no use. But that has always been the case with fiat currencies, right? If everyone suddenly stops believing that the U.S. is going to be able to back up the dollar becomes valueless. Voila. That's how it works.
Didn't China refuse to exchange Bitcoin?
Yes.
And then the value of Bitcoin, what was it, a week or two ago? Just I don't remember what it did, but it dropped.
Right? Yeah, it dropped precipitously. But it also didn't stop being used in China, which I think is interesting. So, yeah, thank you.
I spent, in my working life, I'm retired now, more than 25 years with very sensitive data, medical records type, mm-hmm. and financial records of hospital patients, and many of us people did, and this is, you know, like, we're really near Harborview Hospital, Virginia Mason Hospital, blah, 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 Swedish Hospital, and yet the data that these hospitals have on each one of us, depending upon wherever we went, anywhere mm-hmm. in the world, mm-hmm. Is only what they had when we were there.
Yes.
In other words, I was over at Virginia Mason Hospital today, talked to a financial counselor, and she was able to verify who I last saw for my wrist injury in 2007 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't have any information as to whether or not I'm eligible now for charity care, which I was then.
Mm-hmm.
But they also asked me at that time whether it was an injury that was somebody else's fault, and there kind of really wasn't, except that I slipped
right.
in a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we have a lot of really odd fraud.
Right.
And at the same time, I care about my online reputation, but what do I do about the fact that there's other people with the same name as me who
right.
are not me?
So is the problem more about how you uniquely identify yourself?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when I was working, I never thought about the fact that there may be somebody else named the same name as me.
Right.
Then I
right.
found out in the 21st century that there was.
Yep.
I happens. Kind of vaguely thought about it before, but I didn't have time to think about it.
Right. So what?
Because I knew what I did for a living, and I knew that nobody was going to confuse me with someone who was not working
right.
or someone who was under 18.
Yes, although it is sometimes nice when that happens. So what you're describing is something that we're starting to see as being a prevailing aspect of cryptography or some of the new technologies that is really, really useful, which is to say that you can use a bit of complex mathematics to represent yourself without having to attach your real-world identity. So to give you an example, I can go on Flickr and post my pictures of apple pies, which are stylized in a certain way, and attach them to an identity called DragonRider15. And I can then go over into a Yahoo forum and start making comments about the brony concert that I went to recently as, you know, brony fan 112 or whatever it is. And I can then sign that with a bit of math that verifies that those two are related, right? Neither of those bits of information will indicate who I am in the real world, which can be really useful. I can do the same thing to then connect it to my Bitcoin account so I can do transactions or whatever. What's nice about that is it means that I can then explore a variety of different kinds of relationships and have people be really certain that the reputation that I've put up as a fan, you know, someone who makes pictures of apple pies, and the reputation that I've put up as someone who's a fan of My Little Pony are both actually connected. So it gets around the problem of being identified as someone who is 18 when I'm not that person, and also lets me take that reputation and export it to other platforms, which is helpful because if I'm going to babysit your children, you might want to know, you know, who I am on these other platforms. Did you have a question?
So my question is a follow-up to the Target question. So the Target example doesn't really surprise me. I mean, I know when I sign on to Facebook, all the ads are created specifically for me, but you mentioned pricing in your talk. And so I know, for example, that when my family and I would go back to Asia, we always compare the prices for certain products to see if I can get it cheaper when I'm in Hong Kong. I mean, how specific is that, though? I mean, I can see why it would be different from country to country, but should I be, like, going over to my friend's, my guy friend's house and, like, logging into his Amazon account to buy beauty products or something from now on? Like, should I start worrying about that?
I guess it depends on your guy friends. We don't know, right? And this is part of what's really interesting about it, is the data is out there, but it's not being universally applied. And the degree to which different companies are going to use this to modify their dynamic pricing is changing all the time. Target, for example, is very unlikely to emphasize their data gathering around pregnant women for quite a while because it was a huge backlash against them. And maybe other companies have learned from their example. But at the same time, you know, you've got stuff like the patents by Microsoft or the Amazon's pricing strategy, which is making them money. And so they're starting to deploy it in as many ways as they can. How pervasive is it? How much they're modifying their prices? How, you know, how significant it is for you buying beauty products versus me buying, you know, I don't know what hypermasculine example I could use here. You know, we don't know yet. But I think we're going to start seeing more examples of it. In terms of what to do today, try logging in with your boyfriend's Amazon account. Maybe you'll get a deal. I mean, it's worth trying.
Joshua Klein, the author of Reputation Economics: Why Who You Know Is Worth More Than What You Have. He spoke at Town Hall on January 9th, 2014. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. You can also follow us on Twitter at @KUOWSpeakers. Posey Gruner recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Hernia Center at Northwest Hospital, established to serve the entire region, featuring surgical specialists dedicated to treating patients with all types of hernia conditions. More information online at uwmedicine.org/hernia. Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance Proton Therapy, a ProCure center. At SCCA Proton Therapy, doctors treat prostate cancer and certain other cancers by precisely targeting tumors while minimizing effects on surrounding tissue. More at SCCAProtonTherapy.com. Just about 10 o'clock, KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle, 1340, KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and digital HD services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Lows tonight for the Seattle area in the 20s, mostly cloudy, chance of light snow or flurries mainly this evening. For Friday, it's highs lower to mid-30s, mostly cloudy.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.